Blackhawks skate in Minnesota tonight. The forecast, cloudy and warm, light rain and patchy fog in the morning, then a sunny afternoon, a high of 66 inland, 60 near Lake Michigan. Right now, 54 degrees, Racine, Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, under a gray sky. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, that is up next.
Support for the WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That wonderful guitar playing is courtesy of David Maldonado, and this is off of his most recent album called Davicas, and we are really pleased to be able to welcome David Maldonado to our morning show today, because the city of Kenosha is about to welcome him to town for the next concert of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, which is going to be in on Saturday evening, February 25th, in Ruther High School Auditorium. This is a concert which is been titled Noche de Pasión, 100 Years of Spanish Guitar. And guitar virtuoso David Maldonado will be in the spotlight that night. He is a flamenco composer primarily, and has played the guitar for a long, long time and explored various styles of music. And Kenosha is indeed honored to have a musician of his stature coming to town and being part of this very, very special evening. And by the way, an artist reception is actually preceding Saturday night's concert. That's going to happen in partnership with the Kenosha Public Museum, and that reception will be there in the afternoon from 3 until 5. But in the meantime, for the next few minutes on today's morning show, guitarist, composer David Maldonado, we welcome you.
Hi, how's it going?
Just fine.
Good to be here.
I'm just absolutely delighted to be speaking with you. Over the course of the Kenosha Symphony's long history, there have been a tiny handful of classical guitarists who have taken the stage with the group, including Sharon Isbin some years back, but it has been a while. And so this is an overdue special treat. And on top of it, I think you're going to be doing some very special things that none of the previous guitar soloists with the orchestra have done. Let's begin, if we could, by finding out a little bit about where you come from, where you were born and raised, and at what point music and what kind of music became an important part of your life.
Well, that's always fun to talk about, you know, because even though my music is primarily from the region of southern Spain, I was born actually in Mexico and grew up there for a bit, and then grew up my later years in Arizona. So the way that I was introduced to the Spanish part of it is because I was always raised playing guitar, you know, with my parents and my grandparents. They're all musicians. And at one point, you know, when we get into our teenage years, we get a little bit rebellious and know-it-all kind of attitude. And so at that point, I was taken on as a prodigy to the University of Arizona. And we had to move to California because my dad got a job out there, a better job. And the royal family of the classical guitar took me under their wing, the Romeros. And because they saw I felt like I was such a hot shot, you know, they started challenging me with some flamenco pieces. I was primarily just classical. And so they, in order to slow me down, they challenged me with some flamenco pieces. The godfather of flamenco, the hardest pieces. And so being that I was a teenager at the time, I took those pieces, and instead of slowing down, I went the other way. I just was just passionate about it. I was consumed by flamenco and just started ripping the scales and playing everything I could out of flamenco. So after that, finding that I was so drawn to it and so passionate to flamenco, I learned that's when I started asking questions, where's our family from? And some of our families from Barcelona and Madrid, and that's where we all come from. So my whole life, I thought we were just, you know, from the Mexican region, but we all come from the Spanish area.
Huh. And so you actually have some ties in terms of your family with this tradition of flamenco. For those of our listeners who have only just kind of heard the term flamenco, but never really understood much beyond just the name itself, can you give us a sense of just how long this tradition is and what it encompasses?
Yes, flamenco dates back to a lot of the persecution that the gypsies, the Moors coming in from the Middle East into southern Spain felt, because they were just like today, there's immigration, you know, they were just, there was a lot of racism, and the Spanish elite from northern Spain, they didn't want any of the gypsies. They even had signs just like in the 50s and 40s, no colors in here, no, only whites can drink from this water fountain. The same thing was going on there with the gypsies. No gypsies allowed. No gypsies can walk through here. And basically, they lived in caravans and in, you know, these carriages. But the funny thing about it is that they were very musical. And so all of their songs are laments to their suffering of the traveling and starving to death and being, you know, shunned upon by everybody. So flamenco, it never really, there isn't a definition of where that word came from. Some people think it came from like some Flemish involved in there and whatnot, but it was a melting pot of gypsies merging into southern Spain from the Middle East and other regions. So no one really knows where that term came from. However, I have a funny story about that, because in those days, they had no like anything, so they used to, in order to make music, they used to use their claps, which they call in Spanish palmas. They used to clap and sing to claps and dance, and their feet would be the percussion of it. The guitar came much later. The guitar was just an added element, so they used to make guitars out of the cheapest wood there, which, like, to us, plywood. If someone made a guitar out of plywood, it'd sound horrible. But back then, they had the Spanish cedar that they'd use for firewood, everything like that. Now, Spanish cedar is so expensive, and it sounds so amazing on a guitar. Back then, they were burning it and making crappy guitars out of it. But it's hard to get now.
Wow. So, in other words, the musical roots of flamenco was involved, in a sense, the most primitive of means. I mean, not fancy instruments at all.
They
energy.
Their knuckles on tables for, you know, it was just like a whole production of stomp. But, you know, they just all rhythms. That's why flamenco is so hard to understand, because they mastered all these rhythms from all these areas that they were traveling through. For instance, like here we count a song, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, or a waltz is 1, 2, 3, 2, 2, 3. And it could get a little complicated, but in flamenco, one of the main songs, like one of the songs I'm doing, is a bulería, and that you start counting it on the number 12. You know, so it's hard to explain to someone how to play flamenco rhythms. It takes them a long time to understand. So you start on counting on 12. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And then there's beats on the 3, 6, 7, 8, or they get tricky, 3, 6, 8, and 10. And it just goes from there. But everyone understands what they're doing with the claps and the foot stomping and the snaps and the knuckles on the table. Guitar is just another added element. The guitar came from the northern part of Spain, the classical, Spanish classical, but I'm also going to do some traditional Spanish classical. When the guitar was being used by the gypsies, by flamenco, they used to use, and they brought their skills from the oud in the Middle East, where they used an ostrich feather to play it. Since they were poor and they were migrating, they grew their thumbnail long to replace the ostrich feather. And so they adapted the northern part of the classical guitar with the gypsy part of them playing their flamenco fingernail. And that's how flamenco guitar started, because it has elements of classical guitar. A lot of people don't know really what the difference is, but it's a mixture of classical guitar from northern Spain and the oud of the Middle East merging into the guitar. So it's a little bit harsh, and in flamenco has some percussive feel to it, where you knock, where you hit the guitar, where you mute the strings, where you do all this percussive stuff, and no classical guitarist would ever make any sounds like that on the guitar, much less knock it or hit it, you know.
So it sounds like part of what makes flamenco music so distinctive is the fact that it is a tradition that draws upon all kinds of different influences, in the same way that gypsies traveled here and there and picked up various customs and traditions from various places. So in other words, it is in a sense a somewhat complex sort of tradition with a lot bound up in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of people doing wrong flamenco these days with YouTube out there, you know, but it's always been something that is taught and not really written down. And the gypsies have taken on their role of being, you know, always everyone being against them. So it's always been a guarded secret of flamenco. You know, there's a lot of us that know all of the techniques of flamenco, that I don't have time to teach it. I don't have time to go on YouTube to give a, I don't know, what is it, a demo. So there's a lot of wrong stuff out there, unfortunately, which leads to why people don't listen to it too, because there's no one to explain it correctly, because there's so many elements to it that they think that just some Spanish guitar and some guy in a hat with little bingo balls hanging and someone snapping their fingers at flamenco.
Right, and there's so much more to it.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you took to this very, very quickly. I enjoy that story about how some of the formidable guitarists, part of the famous Romero family, put this in your path, thinking that you, a brash young prodigy, would be sort of intimidated by this sort of new style, foreign to you at the time, and you took to it very, very, very quickly. You are also a composer of flamenco music. Did you begin writing your own music right away, or otherwise at what point did that venture enter the picture?
So when I played guitar serious, when I actually took it serious, I was 10 years old. So there wasn't any composition going up until I was 16 years old. After that, you know, I started, because when I had teachers, they were I was already in college at 15, 14 years old, and teachers would say, okay, I wish I could play it like that. They'd had nothing to offer me, you know. So I was getting very, disinflated. I was getting discouraged. There we go. I was getting discouraged of, like, all these people. I'm like, if no one can teach me anything else, you know, then I started thinking, this sounds wrong, and this sounds wrong in other composers. And that's when my mind started working in a different way. I started writing what I thought the passage should be in a classical song. I started writing what the fingering should be on this to make it easier. Everything to make everything easier and sound fuller and better, or bring it down. And my mind was working in the composition mode like I hadn't even known. So ever since I was 16, I started writing little things here, little things there. And it was kind of just a love with the manuscript paper and a pencil. You know, I just loved the notes and loved writing and listening to that. And I think, this is a famous song. It has got to be a famous song. And I'm like searching, what does it sound like? And I would never find anything. And I'm like, this is original. And I'd just be surprising me all the time.
So this was, in a sense, a gift that you, in a sense, didn't even realize you had or didn't even fully understand until it was in full flower.
Even in flamenco, you know, I didn't really understand what it was, but it was in the blood, you know. And then later I find out by asking my parents, like, well, why am I so drawn? Well, you, this part of your family's from Barcelona. Your dad's part of family's from Madrid. We came here at an early time because we didn't want to be part of the Spanish Civil War, and we renounced Spain, and we're Mexican. I'm like, oh, okay. So
you knew who you were at that point.
Yeah, and I just couldn't figure out why I was so drawn to it, and why I wasn't drawn to, let's say, mariachi music or the Mexican stuff that I love so much. Why didn't I want to play that, even though I loved it?
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with guitarist and composer David Maldonado, and he is the guest soloist of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra for their next concert, which is coming up this Saturday, February 25th, a concert 7:30 p.m. at Reuther High School Auditorium. Ahead of that, in the afternoon between 3 and 5, there is a reception at the Kenosha Public Museum where you can meet Mr. Maldonado. You mentioned, maybe it was even before we went on the air, that one of the things that you are happiest about in terms of this upcoming engagement with the Kenosha Symphony is that, in a sense, it takes you back to an earlier phase in your life when you were quite interested in the full symphony orchestra. So tell us about that. Tell us about the kind of work you have done or the composition you have done for full-fledged orchestras versus other kinds of ensembles or simply solo guitar for which you have composed.
Yeah, no problem. So I'm one of the last living Spanish composers on earth. Okay, so I did not know that until people kept telling me that there's nobody else that's doing what you do. But I was doing it in my late teens, in my early 20s, writing songs. But then I thought, okay, there's this. I have to release an album for history. You know, I need to release an album of some sort. However, after two record label signings and, you know, just selling CDs, there was a whole smooth jazz and new age thing, and the Gypsy Kings that, you know, were really popular. They kind of made flamenco music like a mainstream thing. It's not even really flamenco. It's just like pop with Spanish guitar in it. So my agents and my managers and my record labels told me to bring it down. So we brought it down to maybe like a drums, bass, guitar, that's the instrumental music. And it was popular. I released three albums worldwide that were selling like crazy, mostly in nine Asian countries. They were going crazy selling them there. But it's kind of disheartening to keep playing all this. And even though people are saying, you're so amazing, this music just moves me, blah, 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 I wasn't feeling it because I scrunched it down to a popular song instead of what it really was. Now, this album that I just released, you know, I've been through a lot of stuff in my family. Some people have died. I have two children. I'm a single dad. And I said, okay, this is going to be my, I don't even know why I'm going to record another album. It's like no one buys albums. They're all downloading. But I'm going to record this one anyway. And this is going to be one of my last albums that I'm going to record. And I did. And it's called Davigas. I just released it in September, and it debuted at number 2 on the Billboard World Charts. It stayed up there for 8 weeks, and it's one of my proudest albums. However, this is the album that I've been wanting to make since I was a teenager. And at the same time, when I write this album, I'm also thinking in a symphonic format. So when I was approached by my current manager, my most awesome manager, Julie Perez, she said, you should do this. And I did the symphony. And she actually challenged me. She goes, I've never seen any of this in symphonic form. I'm like, well, I could do it. I have this program on my computer. Let's see if it works. So after a million mouse clicks, inputting notes for flute and oboe and violin and this and that, it's amazing. It's so amazing. I'm just sitting back looking at the conductor score, and I'm like, this is exactly what this song is supposed to be. This is exactly what it is. Because when you condense it down to only a few instruments, there's so many voicings that are missing that only I hear. And now I have the ability to all the voicings to be heard. And I'm excited that I just came full circle from when I started writing symphonies to back into the symphonic form.
Right. So give our listeners some sense of the kind of repertoire that is going to be performed at Saturday night's concert. I know that some of what you will play, you will be, in a sense, in the spotlight by yourself as a soloist, but you'll be playing a number of pieces with the orchestra. Explain just what people are going to hear and maybe see Saturday night.
Okay, so the show's concept is 100 years of the Spanish guitar in one night. So I go all the way back to actually a little bit further. I go to the late 1800s to where flamenco was just starting. And I add some of those elements and add some of the north part of Spain, the classical guitar. So I'm going to be doing some reworked pieces from Agustin Barrios' La Catedral. So La Catedral, I love this. It's a three-movement song that I rearranged, but it's never been done like this. I rearranged and wrote it all up for the orchestra. So we're doing a flamenco symphony. I only heard one flamenco symphony, and it wasn't that great, and I think this is going to be amazing. So I added some flamenco elements to the symphony. So I'm also doing some original pieces in symphonic form, also have never been done, and I've never heard it. That there's a lot of flamenco stuff that goes on that is not just nice chords and whatnot. There's some dissonance. There's some different scales, some even almost Middle Eastern, but not really. I'm doing some solo pieces that I reworked. Like one that's really famous is Leyenda Asturias by Isaac Albéniz. And this song was written for piano. And of course, many people feel it's better on guitar, but classical. So what I did is I do it classical. And here's the thing. There's classical guitars and flamenco guitars. There's no classical and flamenco guitarist, you know, so I've actually merged them too, because classical guys don't really like flamenco guitarists and flamencos really don't like classical guitarists, but I put the elements both together because there's a beauty in classical and there's a beauty in flamenco, and if they're coming together on this song that was written for piano, it makes the song perfect. So on that song, I will have an amazing flamenco dancer that I met when I was touring in Atlanta. And her name is La Candela, the candle, because she's blonde and she's very light complex, so they call her the candle. That's her flamenco name. So I'm going to have her on a couple of my original pieces and that song. And I'm looking forward because she is just beautiful and just brings the flamenco dance to life.
It sounds like it's going to be quite an amazing concert, and it sounds like it also is an opportunity for you to, in a sense, express a variety of gifts that are really important to you as both a guitarist and as a composer.
Yeah, it has to be, because I'm actually even including one of the first songs I ever learned on guitar, and I go into a little bit of detailed stories on where the songs come from, and they all have a meaning in this concert. You know, the one of the first songs, that's a funny story, is one of the first songs I learned on guitar is a song One day I saw him playing 5-6 notes really fast on the guitar, and I was attracted to that, and I just swallowed my pride and went up to him and said, "Can you teach me just that little part? I don't want to learn anything else, just that part." From then on, it consumed my whole being. That is when I could not put the guitar down. Sort of like today's kids with their iPhones and Xbox and Wii U's, the guitar was my 8 to 10 hour vice every day since I was 10 years old, and so just addicted to it. No childhood.
By the way, what does it feel like from a technical point of view to play flamenco music or music in the flamenco style versus, for instance, the kind of classical guitar that you played very early on? I mean, pieces by, I would presume, Vivaldi and Mozart is listed in your biography. I mean, from a technical point of view, are you playing the guitar in a completely different way?
Yes. So let me put it this way. If you are a, let's say, pop guitarist, let's say if you're playing pop guitar for Miley Cyrus or Britney Spears up there, and then you go play with sit in with the Ramones at CBGB's in New York. So when you're playing pop guitar, you're playing a certain style, and then when you go play punk rock, you're just driving in the strings like crazy and releasing some kind of anger that goes on. That's the same thing with classical. Classical is beautiful and passionate, and you're feeling these soft tones and maybe some heavy tones. And then when you play flamenco, you're really digging. I have to use two different guitars. They're not the same. I'm really digging into the strings. I'm doing all this percussive stuff. Every, let me see, 5 seconds, there's an accent that I have to strum at the same time. And you're just, it's a different feel. You know, although both of them are really passionate, they're really beautiful. One, you're a little bit more careful and grabbing the strings. The other, you're just driving the strings almost to, I won't think I'm going to break them, but that's why I use extra heavy tension strings.
Well, we are really excited about this exceptionally rare honor of welcoming you to town and of being able to experience your very distinctive artistry in this concert with the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. Again, the concert is this Saturday evening at 7:30 at Reuther High School. And before that, a public reception at the Kenosha Public Museum between 3 and 5, which will be an opportunity for people to actually meet you and learn more about you and about your music. And we're going to hear more of that in just a moment. But in the meantime, David Maldonado, I want to thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I congratulate you on all of your great success thus far, and look forward to seeing and hearing you this weekend as you perform with the Kenosha Symphony. Best wishes to you.
Thank you. I'm so excited, and I really want to meet as many people as I can.
And here is a bit more music of David Maldonado. This is Romance de la Muerte, which comes from his latest album, David Cass. For more information on Saturday night's concert, with David Maldonado. You can go to the symphony's website, kenoshasymphony.org, or you can call them at 262-220-7526. It's 8:40. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. Now from the archives, a portion of a conversation I had with Tom Moon, a well-known personality on public radio, a musical critic, and the author of several different books, including 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, A Listener's Life Guide. In this book, he lists 1,000 different albums, and one of the main points he makes is that we really encounter an artist in a very special and complete way when we listen to their complete albums, not just to the individual songs which they have recorded. So here's a portion of that conversation.
You have been a music lover for a long time. Your biography says you did most of your growing up in record stores and rehearsal rooms. So can we gather that even as a young person growing up, I mean, music was what really mattered to you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. My father died when I was 2. And by the time I got old enough to really understand what that meant, I was already a pretty big listener. And I can remember coming back from summer camp one time and telling my mom this counselor was playing this group, Simon and Garfinkel, which is how I remembered it. And we had to have some of that in our house. And, of course, she knew who they were and got us whatever the record was at the time, I forget. But, yeah, it was like that. I was probably 7 or 8 years old at the time.
Wow. From the beginning, have you had this amazingly wide interest, a wide-ranging interest in music? I mean, as I look at this list and read your introduction, that's one of the things that is most striking to me.
Yeah, no, I can't claim that at all. In my listening as a kid, I was mostly interested in rock and roll. And when I went on past high school, I went to music school, and there I became really obsessed with jazz. And out of that grew this sort of more wide-ranging curiosity about other music, which was fed greatly by the experience of being a music critic. You know, when you play music, you sort of assume that you can navigate any style, and once you attain a certain proficiency on an instrument, you can just basically go anywhere and try and play anything. And that's true, but I found that I was not until I actually started writing about music did I try and really test that. And I found myself living in Miami, covering incredible Latin music that was completely alien to my experience up till that point.
Tell us a little bit about specifically the kind of music making you did personally.
Oh, sure. Well, I started out in Miami playing professionally there and played, as I said, a lot of Latin music, but also weddings, bar mitzvahs. I worked on cruise ships for a long time, a couple years, different cruise lines where, you know, you'd play in essentially a pit orchestra and they'd bring you different acts in every week. Sometimes it was as simple as playing a comic on and off the stage. Sometimes it was something like the Fifth Dimension, say, where you'd actually back the band up for the whole show. And I did that kind of work in Miami as well. I played behind Tony Bennett, Gladys Knight and the Pips, a bunch of acts. In those days, I'm talking about the early 80s, there were shows at many of the Miami Beach and north of Miami Beach hotels. Like, they would have big showrooms, and snowbirds from the Northeast would come, and the showrooms would be packed, and you'd play 4 or 5 nights a week of that. I was also, I played in rock bands that toured the Southeast, sort of from Florida up through, like, Norfolk, Virginia, that area. And I was on the road with Maynard Ferguson for a year with his big band. Actually, at the time, it was a little big band with 5 horn players, but a great experience and wonderful to play with him every night.
So at what point did classical music start to figure in your interest?
My listening was only as far as I went in school with classical music. In other words, most every music school still teaches theory and the basic rudiments of ear training, using classical music. And beyond that, at the University of Miami, where my degree is in this absurd specialty called studio music and jazz, but there we did read scores, and we certainly took music history as it exists pre-jazz, certainly all the way through the classics. And so I had some working knowledge of classical music, even though I had no concept of what the repertoire was. And I could sort of make you a rough timeline, but I couldn't pick out necessarily the great versions of specific pieces. And for this project, I used the help of a guru, my colleague at the Philadelphia Inquirer, David Patrick Stearns, who shared with me enormous amounts of music, opened his library, and did the very wise thing of not saying to me, well, you must use this version of this piece. He would say, this is the version I have. Check out these other versions. And often I did that and came up with different answers than he would have. But I had his grounding and his sort of insight into why the piece is important and what to listen for in the various interpretations.
So now when you just roll out of bed, or if you were stranded on a desert island, or, I mean, however you want to have the question phrased to you, what still would you have to say in your heart of hearts is the music that you most profoundly enjoy on just a personal level?
You know, this experience, I spent 3.5 years searching for these great records, and that's all I was looking for, by the way. I was just looking for peak experiences. Some of them were like the world culture greatest hits, where most reasonable people would say, oh, yes, in a book like this, we must represent the Beatles, we must represent Beethoven. But then as I went beyond those and looked for some of the, you know, sort of needle in a haystack type of records, things that people might have missed, I was still just looking for peak experiences. And what the process of going and searching taught me was this idea that's on the cover of the book. It says, the more you love music, the more music you love. And I really believe that. And I don't think now I could say, well, you know, jazz is still my street, and that's where I live. I like all of it, and on any given day, I'll find myself listening to the great French composer Eric Satie, or, you know, Queen Latifah, or all kinds of different things.
You point out in the introduction to the book that music is so ubiquitous that we tend to take it for granted, until, that is, we find ourselves awestruck by some incredible sound we've never heard before. I really like how you put that, but it occurs to me that for somebody who likes hip-hop and nothing but hip-hop, or if somebody likes Haydn string quartets and nothing but string quartets, if they choose to just kind of live on that musical cul-de-sac, they are never likely to experience what you just talked about. I mean, unless completely by accident. But, I mean, it is entirely possible to insulate yourself from ever having that experience of an incredible new sound that you didn't even know existed.
Well, you're right. And that's the big problem, I think, in the culture right now. The culture, in many ways, says, go after what you like. Hit that instant gratification button over and over again. And what I was looking for, what my mission was, if I could say it as a mission, was to sort of create the idea that there's nothing wrong with just seeking, and that in the process of exploring, whether you start out in the hip-hop tribe or the classical tribe or wherever, if you're willing to take one step outside your comfort zone, you may find that your mind is blown by something. And that kept happening to me. And whenever I thought I knew some style, somebody would say, well, what about that record? And I'd listen to it, and I'd be like, yeah, that's unbelievable. And I think that while it's true that most people don't get that great eureka moment on their own, there are people that once they start exploring a little bit, they have that experience of wanting more of that. And so I think that if we can get past this sort of cultural place that says it's okay to live in your cul-de-sac, you know, follow your bliss, and instead says you can appreciate the music that you love on a deeper level if you give yourself the chance to listen to things that you maybe will never love. And if you just go after trying to expand your horizons for the sake of just expanding your ears and not for necessarily even finding another great style of music that you love. You know what I'm saying? It's like it's almost like in order to find anything that's going to stay with you forever, you almost have to be willing to go into places that you won't go back to.
Well, right. I mean, I think that's I really think that's true. I mean, I will on rare occasion listen to something like rap if only to just reinforce my love of melody, which is, you know, as a lover of opera, for instance. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, rap is kind of the antithesis of it, although it has certain things that make it exciting and so on. But I find that I love a Puccinian melody even more when I experience a little bit of music that essentially has no melody.
Well, I wouldn't say hip-hop has no melody. I would say that it's a whole different melodic vocabulary.
Right.
But not to say that one's better than the other, you know, but that exact point, that idea of taking what you know into something you don't know and interfacing with something you don't know, there is that in itself, just doing that, even if it's 5 minutes, changes the way you hear everything else. And, you know, I think that my concern about kids now is that, you know, they hear what happens on Guitar Hero, the game, say, and they think they know rock guitar. And as we know, even something as finite as rock guitar is actually very vast. And, you know, my mission here, again, my goal is to say to that kid who, you know, thinks he knows rock guitar because he knows how to play Aerosmith on Guitar Hero, but check out Jimi Hendrix. Well, but check out, you know, Wes Montgomery, the great jazz guitarist, and then go further and check out Andre Segovia. And, you know, just through the lens of the guitar, you can have, you know, your world expanded 10 times.
We're speaking with Tom Moon about his book, 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. So you undertook this amazing idea of amassing this huge list. And you talk about in the introduction how you were trying partly to sort of put aside what you call the cataclysmic shifts which have occurred as of late in the music business. This list has nothing to do really with any of that. It's about the music. I mean, no matter how it comes to you, whether you're playing it on an LP or you're downloading it to your iPod or whatever, this is about the music itself. And as daunting as the challenge had to be, I'm sure there was something kind of refreshing about sort of leaving the business of music largely behind you.
Yes, exactly. And very interesting experience I had, because during that 3.5 years when I'm off exploring, the industry's good. Every headline about the industry is saying times are bad in the music industry, music's awful. And I was having the exact other experience. I was finding so much great music, and there was so much energy coming out of these recordings that I'd be like, hey, music's fine. You know, the delivery systems and the business part of it is another question. Two things that I found, were the main one being that old idea of the album, whether it's a long-playing thing or on a CD, is actually the best way to encounter music. This idea that we pick at 99 cents a track from an a la carte menu and just sort of dip our toes into a lot of different music that way is great for an initial exploration, and I did that a lot as I was researching. But then almost every case, there are some singles in the book and there's some discrete small pieces of music, but most of the book is albums because I kept wanting more. And even when you find one great quintessential single, often the rest of the stuff on the record, even if it's not necessarily all at that level, has a lot to teach you. And I think that as our attention span has shortened, we've had this unfortunate thing where we won't give an artist 40 minutes to tell a story anymore. And that idea of sort of relinquishing, giving that attention to someone and sort of interfacing with what their idea of the world is at the point at which they're making this record, that's really important. The other thing that I discovered, and this relates back to the business, is that a lot of the great albums are not being cared for properly by their corporate overlords, which is to say that there's a whole lot of music that should be available in its original form that the labels are instead releasing on greatest hits types records and anthologies, which sometimes that represents most of the music, but not always. And the labels themselves don't see themselves as caretakers of legacies anymore.
Right.
And they're not actually helping connect the great artists of the past with the audiences of the present the way they once did.
The specific example you give in the introduction is some Loretta Lynn album that you think is, you know, an example of one of these great albums where you go on a journey from the first band to the last band, and and apparently you can't get that album intact anymore. And you say to some, that's like having War and Peace go out of print. And then you say it's more than an outrage, it's a sign that the folks in charge don't appreciate the treasures in their own vaults.
And I believe that's true. And what's interesting about that as it relates to Loretta Lynn is that Loretta record is great, but it does, but like many records out of Nashville of that era in the 60s or in 70s, it has some clunkers on it. And part of what I'm saying about the album experience is you almost owe it to yourself to hear the clunkers and not just experience Loretta Lynn's journey as an artist through her greatest hits, because there's something about her having to contend with material that isn't as good as, you know, her hits that it's illuminating.
Oh, absolutely. That's a very good way to put it. I mean, an example in my life would be the first record I bought with my own money, which would be back when I was 10, and I bought the Supremes. They weren't yet Diana Ross and the Supremes. Mm-hmm. I Hear a Symphony.
Yeah.
And on that record are all kinds of great hits, like I Hear a Symphony and Stop in the Name of Love.
Yeah.
But there are other tracks on that are not at all part of their greatest hits, like their arrangement of Stranger in Paradise or Any Girl in Love, which I liked because you heard so much more from the two backup singers than from Diana Ross.
Sure.
I mean, there is often something compelling in those tracks or bands where the group is stepping out of their own comfort zone a little bit or maybe showcasing some different facet of what they do. And you're absolutely right. Often it's those things that are not at all likely to appear on a greatest hits compilation. And you're saying if you can't get that original album, you're really losing out on something.
Well, sure. Part of the group's history is in that original album. And I'm not saying that in every case that's the way to go, but in some cases it sure is. And just if you want to really know about the Supremes, if you want to really know about any artist, you want to dive deeply enough and also go with what they presented to the world as their statement at any given time. I mean, it's one thing, for example, to hear one track from Bob Dylan's Highway 61, and it's another thing to actually encounter the album as he put it together.
Tom Moon is responsible for this really fascinating book called 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, A Listener's Life Guide. Tomorrow on the morning show, several different interviews, including one with Jonathan Starr, the author of a fascinating new book called It Takes a School. It tells the story of how Jonathan Starr left behind a very successful career as an investment broker in New York City and moved to Somaliland, one of the poorest and most violence-racked nations in Africa, in order to open a school there. It's an amazing and inspiring story. On Thursday's morning show, Nan Calvert and a preview of the upcoming EcoFest. On Friday for Black History Month, from the archives, an interview about the great American George Washington Carver. The Morning Show airs every